tonight. So this is the 13th of March. For the record, I will be leaving right after we finish tonight because tomorrow's my wife's birthday, and she hasn't seen a lot of her husband lately because he's finishing a book. And so I'm going to scootle out here fairly briskly. So that's just the deal. Okay, so it's March 13th, 2013. And if, as you know, recently we've been kind of exploring relationships and relationship issues, the down and dirty around, and last week it was boundaries and boundary problems. And I wanted to take that another step tonight, but begin with, as we did last time, a couple or a handful of examples of particular situations around, you know, important relationships, significant relationships, where typically there's some kind of struggle or tension or hurt or just chilly politeness. And at the heart of it in some way is maybe a question of boundaries, where one feels one's own boundaries have been violated, one's been taken advantage of, talked over, pushed around, cut off, not appreciated. Or there's a desire to influence this other person to, you know, put the darn cup in the dishwasher the right way. All right? So what would be perhaps a few examples of boundary issues or relationship issues in general? Just a few examples, if you're willing to speak up. Great.
One of the hardest ones is the parent-child relationship.
Yeah. Right.
And also the reverse direction of them violating your boundary.
Yeah, great. Do you have a, you know, disguise the innocent if you like, but is there a concrete instance of that? You know, without going into too much depth, you know, the half minute or less version, but something concrete?
Well, with children, it's really nice when they participate in things that help, you know, keep the house functioning,
yeah.
Cars functioning,
right.
You know, those kinds of things that
yep.
often teenage children
right, right, like not throwing hand towels right next to the floor of the toilet. Oh, okay. Or helping, you know, with dinner occasionally, or, oh, okay, that kind of thing, all right, okay. Not that I'd ever know from personal experience. All right, any other example? Great.
Okay, well, since you mentioned the toilet.
Lit up or down, one of those, is that it?
But it's not a problem for me anymore. But I do notice it in public places that it's a problem for other women.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. All right, we know that one. All right, yeah, great.
Well, sometimes in second marriages, blended families don't blend.
Yeah, that's a major, yeah.
And sometimes the lack of acceptance that the spouse's children have, especially the daughters of a husband who will not accept the second wife.
Yeah. Yeah.
So setting boundaries around that and saying, that's not my problem.
Right. That's good. Thank you. Very relevant. Maybe one more? Any others? Great. Julie?
I have a younger sister in Arizona who is rapidly using the little money that she has for the rest of her life, is losing control over all of the business functions because of personal, physical, medical problems she has, and yet sees herself as fully competent to handle them, except she just doesn't have time. We're very concerned in the
right.
family, and that's a real boundary issue for us.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, good, good range here. So what to do, right? And kind of the genesis for this inquiry was someone asked me a couple weeks ago, all right, Rick, what would the Buddha say about boundaries? And I thought, isn't this interesting? How do we talk about boundaries in a teaching that's so much about interdependence, right? And the emptiness of any apparently bounded thing, including a thought, a feeling, a taste, touch, or a smell. So what to do about that? Now, also it's true that I'm certainly not the entire repository of wisdom about boundary issues. You know, it's a work in progress, so I don't mean to pretend that I have like the ultimate right answer. I'm just kind of sharing with you, and we're going to explore together some different angles on this, including how to use the wisdom teachings of the Buddha applied to down and dirty real issues. Okay. Now, Last week, we talked about practical ways of various kinds to sort of address what was happening over there on the other side of the street. And a piece of that teaching, which I think is sort of half of what to do with regard to boundaries, and I'll name the second half in a moment, that part of the teaching, if you will, is around equanimity, where we come to a kind of peacefulness whereby we recognize that the other person is the primary, if you will, source of the causes in their own life, or even more exactly, a whole bunch of causes are streaming through that person's life, most of which have nothing to do with us, and frankly, most of which don't even have to do with that other person. That other person, as each of us is like a kind of standing wave through which rivers of causes are streaming. The previous moment, the moment before that moment, the way that person was raised, that person's genetics, person's gender, race, class, their parents, parents, parents' history, and all the rest of that. And equanimity is to appreciate the fact that their karma is their karma, your karma is your karma. In other words, that they are the recipient of those causes streaming through, and the truth is there are a lot of limits to our influence. So we do what we can, and we operate in this ideally kind of balanced place where we're both intimately related to the person in some appropriate way, depending on the situation. We have goodwill for them and benevolence. We also are practicing our own virtue, while at the same time recognizing equanimity, recognizing that we don't need to be implicated in their mind stream. That is, you know, that's at least a class four rapid, right? On those 1 to 5 scale, you know, and there's no 6. It's not like Spinal Tap, where you just turn it up to 12 or 11, you know. It just stops at 5. But anyway, you know, that's a high bar. But it's realistic, and although it's typically a work in progress. So that's sort of one half of the coin, that part being around equanimity and coming to peace with the limits of our influence, whether it's over our children or our sister or anybody else. But there's another side to the story, the other half of the piece, or the other side of the coin, at least in my conception of this, and that is to do our own practice over here and to be self-reliant over here to do our own work. And that's the part of it I'd like to talk about tonight, self-reliance. And when I use the word self in this way, I really mean person reliance, not ego reliance or I reliance, but the person in the broadest sense. And yet a person who is individual, who is unique, who is distinct from other persons, who have different social security numbers, if nothing else. All right. And it's interesting, so I pulled out a variety of teachings from the Buddha, and I think what I'll do too, if you like, is I have your email address, I assume, and if I don't, if you don't get stuff from me about this sitting group, I don't have your email address. So if you want to give me your email address for this sitting group, which I'll never share with anyone else, you can, I think, put it on that piece of paper over there. Please print neatly. And what I'll do is, if you like, I'll send out these, I think there are about a dozen passages, very, very short clips, mainly from the Dhammapada. They're quite short. If you like, I'll send them out to people who get the sitting group email list. Okay. So what do we do about our side of the street, right? And the first thing I want to read here speaks to how do we motivate ourselves to take good care of ourselves? We've come back to where I began tonight by inviting you to look around the room, see the wholeheartedness and the good-heartedness in others, and to realize that they're seeing it in you as well. So for me, there are probably two primary ways to be motivated to cultivate self-reliance, to take care of myself. The first is that warm-heartedness. It's emotional. And so I want to invite you right now, if you like, to do a kind of a half-minute practice with me to kindle some of that warm-heartedness for yourself. So to begin with, and it's 3 steps, and it's a practice I do routinely, it's quite internal. In the first step, bring to mind The feeling of being with someone who loves you. So you might think of someone in your life today or in your past. The word love can be quite broad. Someone who likes you, who appreciates you, includes you, even cherishes you. Could be a human being, could be a pet, could be a spirit being. So take a moment to see if you can call up the felt sense of being loved by someone or cared about. If you can't find that sense, it's okay, but see if you can. Keep trying. What's it like to feel liked? What's it like to feel seen or appreciated? On the receiving end of someone being warm or friendly. Okay. Then the second step, letting the feeling of being cared about move to the background of your mind, bring to mind someone that it's naturally easy to feel caring for. Maybe a friend in need, could be a child. Someone that's naturally easy to have compassion for, or love, or like. And be mindful of what it's like to be caring or affectionate or cherishing toward that person. Know what it's like to feel caring. To wish well, to wish that others not suffer, to wish that others be happy. To have a loyalty to others, to have a commitment to them, to be for them. What's that like? And then in the third step, see if you can swing that quality of caring, of being for someone, swing it and apply it to yourself. Maybe see yourself outside you, or simply kind of know it inside. See if you can find a quality of being on your own side, of wishing yourself well, of having a basic kindness toward yourself. You might find a kind of almost animal vitality inside, the will to survive, or to even more to flourish and thrive. A sense of a determination not to be beaten down by life. It might show up for you like that. Or even simply a kind of sweetness for yourself. Okay, so then coming back, whatever you experienced was fine. By the way, as I saw some people doing it, you can strengthen this experience if you want with a hand on your cheek as if the most loving being in the universe was caressing you with love, or a hand on your heart. There's a term in psychology called embodied cognition. You could reciprocate with someone as long as it's the right someone, appropriate boundaries, but anyway. Make sure it's invited, but anyway. So that's an emotional way into this. And I go through those three steps because research shows that if we warm up the attachment circuits of the brain by initially experiencing the receiving of caring, that warms us up in terms of the giving of caring, including the application of that giving to ourselves. Okay. A second major way into this is, for me, a more principled or ethical way. And it's illustrated here in this teaching from the Buddha. If one going down into a river, swollen and swiftly flowing, is carried away by the current, how can one help others across? In other words, we can't help others unless, in the cliched example, if we don't put our own oxygen mask on first. You know? In other words, if we're going to help others and we're swept away ourselves with upset or clouded by delusion or caught up in greed or hatred or heartache, we can't help other people. And as many studies show, it's when our own cup runneth over that we have more to give to other people. We're more inclined to be generous, to be altruistic, to be cooperative, to be reasonable, to put up with them, you know, leaving the lid up on the toilet, and all the rest of that, right? So for both out of a kind of warm-heartedness, as well as a basic sense of principle, why do we not deserve the same decent treatment, the same fairness as any other being in the universe, right? For these two kinds of reasons, we can get on our own side. And as the Buddha said in his final teaching of his entire life, make a lamp unto ourselves. So then, what do we do about this once we have this basic sense of self-reliance? And here it's really clear, and the social context is relevant here, that it's our own actions, our own acts of thought, word, and deed that make all the difference in the world. Because that's where the rubber really meets the road. In a context of great social distinctions of his own time, the Brahmins at the top of the heap and the untouchables or the equivalent at the bottom, the Buddha said radically 2,500 years ago, one is not low because of birth, nor does birth make one holy. Deeds alone make one low. Deeds alone make one holy. In other words, it's about action of thought, word, and deed. Not empty ritual or just being carried along by our caste, our birth. We need to enact this quality of being on our own side. So what do these actions look like? Well, to do them, we have to have some faith that they'll bear fruit, the laws of karma. In other words, that actions have consequences for better or worse, right? Here again, the Buddha. Think not lightly of good, saying, it will not come to me. Drop by drop is the water pot filled. Likewise, the wise one, gathering it little by little, fills oneself with good. This is one of my favorite teachings. If they'll let me, I'm going to stick it at the beginning of my book, the one that I'm doing on hardwiring happiness. Think not lightly of good, it will not come to me. Drop by drop is the water pot filled. Likewise, the wise one, gathering it little by little, fills oneself with good. Isn't that beautiful? It's hopeful. It also tells us what to do. With respect, Coach Buddha is saying, do that. You know, whatever it is, you want to improve your golf swing, you want to make more money, you want to get along better with your mate, do this. If you want to truly be free of suffering, gather the good to you drop by drop. That's how the water pot's filled. So we can have faith that the actions we do, based on self-reliance, based on being on our own side, will actually bear fruit over time. So what's the primary target or theater of those actions? If you think about it, there are three great points where we can act upon, or domains we can act in. We can act out there in the world. We can make strong walls. We can send money to Haiti or go there ourselves. We can bake cakes, you know, we can do stuff out in the world, get stop signs put in the right places. We can do things in our own body, take action there, exercise, eat well, don't drink too much, what have you. And we can take action inside our own mind. All are important, they're not mutually exclusive. That said, the Buddha's focus was the mind. And as he says here, No mother nor father nor any other kin can do greater good for oneself than a mind directed well. Now, this is a context where kin was incredibly important 2,500 years ago, and there was enormous respect for mothers and fathers and parents. But he said that, you know, we can direct our own minds well as the primary way, really, to fill the good inside ourselves, to take care of our side of the street. If you think about it, very much when we get involved in conflict with other people, where we feel transgressed in terms of our boundaries, where we want them to act differently, understandably, there's certainly a place for that. But very quickly, to use a term in psychology, we get stimulus bound. We get caught up in them, right? We become entangled. And the Buddha had a lot of teachings about disentangling, right? We get over there with them, trapped by them, rather than having a kind of freedom. I talked last time about the fact that we get too coupled together with other people, as if we're bound to them by a metal bar, so that wherever they go, we have to follow. You know? A different variation of that in a metaphor from the Buddha is a dog chained to a stake. The stake binds the dog. The dog has a little bit of freedom of movement, but ultimately is always caught by the chain, bound to the stake. So it's on us to appreciate that we have to kind of work with our mind, in part disengage what's going on with those other people, and take care of it ourselves. You know, it's so easy. I'm a couples counselor. Probably a lot of you have worked with couples in one way or another. You just see what happens is they're enormously preoccupied with each other. And the beginning of healing is to disentangle the preoccupations. Take care of your needs, take care of your rights, you know, don't be taken advantage of. I call it the 80-20 rule. Sure, put 20% of your attention on how they could be a better partner, and the rest of it, unilaterally, be a better partner yourself. Including disengaging from people that harm you, or doing everything you can, and sometimes, unfortunately, there are limits, to preventing them from continuing to harm you. But again, that's on you. I mean, yes, make requests, insist that they stop doing your thing, but are you going to the max you actually can yourself, unilaterally, to stop them from harming you? I know a lot of situations where people basically say to the other person, please stop harming me, please stop harming me, don't hit me anymore. I mean, figuratively, not literally. But then they don't do what they could do themselves to make it stop happening. So we need to take care of ourselves. So here's another quote. You are your own protector. You are your own refuge. And then he follows it by saying, therefore, you should control yourself even as a horse dealer controls a noble steed. Isn't that interesting? The Buddha goes from, right, you are your own protector, you are your own refuge, and then the follow-on is self-control. Now, by the way, it seems a little warm in here, a little stuffy. I think we could open that door to the foyer and maybe open that door as well. We might have some insect visitors, but, you know, they live here too. Is that okay? Okay, great. So do you have any comments so far? Yeah.
I just came back from being with my family, and it was a memorial, so there was a certain kind of seriousness about the whole thing. On the other hand, now that I'm safely home again, it feels like I've come home from the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. And what I noticed about myself when I was noticing a couple that were very enmeshed and playing kind of mommy and son and just acting kind of crazy with one another, my niece and her husband, just being quiet, just not saying anything and not trying to, by my, you know, expression, you know, be critical and just let them be. Because they ain't gonna change.
Right.
And it's the same thing with the dynamics of the whole family. And it was the most peaceful time I've ever been with them. But I was very mindful of my boundaries and how quiet and sort of
in a peaceful place, I had to be amongst kind of the craziness, lack of boundaries and enmeshed relationships and all of that. So it was very helpful, but boy, I'm glad to be home.
Right. I mean, I hear in that example that you found freedom through self-control. In a sense, you just retained your own stability here, no matter what storms were swirling around you. And they did their thing, but you weren't coupled to it. And I can just tell you, so many times for me, it has been an incredible refuge to just think to myself, what's my job here?
Yeah.
My job here is not being an asshole. You know, it's kind of a low bar, but not everybody steps over it. Right? So step one, don't be a jerk, you know? Like, that's pretty important. Don't lose it. And then another is, you know, for me, a step further is don't put your foot in it, right? Just don't add insult to injury. Don't, you know, consolidate your gains. In other words, I don't need to win the whole thing. I just need to stabilize this one point being on the table. I just need to know what I'm going to do differently from now on. That's great refuge. Can't change the past. Three incredibly hopeful words from now on. What's my takeaway? What's my focus from this interaction or this grievance that's coming at me, usually wrapped with a whole bunch of crud, right? Because it rarely comes across the net perfectly packaged, correct? Have you ever noticed that? I don't know. Now, maybe they're not the only people that do that. But anyway. So, you know, it's not perfect, but we filter through it. Okay, what's my takeaway? What am I going to implement? What grievances am I going to zero out so I'm not going to give them any more cause for complaint? Thank God. That's motivating. And also, out of benevolence, I'm just going to go to the max. What's their grievance? I'm going to unilaterally do the best I can with it and move on. I'm going to control myself. I'm going to regulate myself. Now, we don't talk a lot about sila or virtue or restraint or self-regulation, but it's one of the three great pillars of practice. Self-restraint, sila, virtue, regulation, concentration, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom or insight. Those are the big three. The Buddha's talking here about one of the three great pillars of practice. And I'll just read you a few of the metaphors he uses. See if they can land on you, you know, in a good way. Here's another one. Irrigators regulate the rivers. Fletchers straighten the arrow shaft. Carpenters shape the wood. The wise control themselves. So if you're caught up in a situation, you might ask yourself, okay, how could I regulate myself better? Now, that doesn't necessarily mean muzzling yourself. Some kind of tight, pinched lip, top down. It might mean I'm going to regulate myself by taking the muzzle off finally. And speaking the truth here and naming the name that doesn't usually get named, which is that Uncle Bob drinks too much, or that Junior needs to pull his weight in the family, or you keep, you know, taking from me, but you don't give much, right? That's regulation as well. But what's my responsibility in this standing wave that is us, right? I'm not going to take all responsibility for all the cause streaming through us, the us of a dyad or a family or an organization or a nation altogether, but what's my piece of the puzzle? And I can regulate around that. That's a very honest inquiry. And as soon as you start asking that question, you're on the moral high ground. Doesn't mean you're superior to the other person, but you're resting in virtue at that point. And there's tremendous self-respect that comes out of knowing that. You begin to occupy what the Buddha called the bliss of blamelessness. Because you know on your side of the street, whatever happened back there, right now, in this moment, you're blameless. Another line, one by one, little by little, moment by moment, a wise one should remove one's own impurities as a smith removes dross from silver. You know, kind of gradually cleansing anger out of the mind stream. Gradually cleansing exaggeration. Holding on to grievance, gradually cleansing hatred out of the mind stream, you know, for example. And also taking care, I think, more generally of our own foundations. You know, it's very interesting. A lot of times in relationships or larger situations, what I observe, and including in myself, what's making things go awry is I'm not watering my own roots. I'm not taking care of my own deep needs. Mm-hmm. I'm getting rattled around little problems or little issues because I'm not taking care of the big issues. I'm not eating properly. I'm not sleeping enough. I'm not meditating. I'm not petting, you know, the lizard enough, as it were. I'm not feeding the mouse or hugging the monkey, as it were, in terms of the three brainstem, subcortex, cortex. I'm not taking care of myself. Got to take care of the little inner menagerie. It's like a sweet little farm, you know? It's like Animal Farm in a good way. But anyway, and as part of that, sometimes we give up those things that maybe help us briefly, but really cost us long term. You know, drinking too much, crazy TV, whatever. You know, we purify ourselves gradually over time. Any comments so far? Yeah.
I just want to mention that it's so interconnected with karma. And I mean, it really is sort of everything.
Yeah.
This upward spiral. Sometimes you can even find the end of the tape developmentally with you're finally practicing enough to get behind the architecture of your own conventional responses and notice what they are.
Yeah. That's great. You're so eloquent how you put it. I mean, a way I relate to that myself is it's a little bit as if we look this way, backwards as it were, from my perspective, the other for you. But, okay, what are the causes, as Emily was saying, that are streaming up through me now creating this moment? And seeing a lot of them as impersonal. And also, then turning around, what are the causes that stream forward for me in my life? And how can I, as Ajahn Chah, the teacher Jack Kornfield put it, how can I tend to those causes from here on out, from now on, right? How can I remove the impurities? How can I regulate my mind? How can I take care of my own side of the street, you know, streaming forward? And then, as I get to momentarily, take refuge and find joy in knowing that I'm doing what I can, living in the bliss of blamelessness, disentangled from the complications and implications of the other people, while at the same time being benevolent toward them and treating them from a virtuous place. I have four closing quotes, including a home run at the end. So, as the Buddha says here, so now it sounds like a lot of work, doesn't it? Okay, removing impurities, bummer, grind. Giving up those pleasant but costly desires, darn, I want those cupcakes, right? Or regulating oneself, oh my God, sounds like a lot of work, right? Can't I just sit, close my eyes and space out? That's so much easier. Yeah? Well, as the Buddha says, better it is to live one day virtuous and meditative than to live 100 years immoral and uncontrolled. And he doesn't mean immoral in reference to some commandments from on high. He means pragmatically, that you're harming yourself and others. Better it is to live one day meditative and controlled than 100 years immoral and uncontrolled. But when you do, because you do, right? You look at the faces around the room, you see the karma, in a sense, the fruits, the results of their prior actions before this moment tonight. In their faces, you see their goodness, their intelligence, their effort, their own sincerity. They saw it in you as well. When you recognize in yourself, as the Buddha says, the doer of good rejoices here and hereafter. One rejoices in both the worlds. He's talking about the next life and the life after that, which you don't have to buy or not, but he's talking about that degree of progression, of appreciation, you know, from prior efforts. The doer of good rejoices here and hereafter. One rejoices in both the worlds. One rejoices and exults, recollecting one's own pure deeds. Wow. It's a lot of pleasure, right? One rejoices and exults. Obviously, he's not talking about ego there, right? But he's saying, wonderful. I wasn't an asshole. One more day, 1 minute at a time. Just don't be a schmo. Good. I was a nice person. I tried. Exaltation. Really, you don't need to be a saint or utterly enlightened. You know, he's not talking about that. Good deeds, right? Then moving toward the end, as he says, make an island of yourself, make yourself your refuge. These are his final words on his deathbed. He's asked, you know, can you set up a bunch of authorities, basically, who will run the whole deal? And he says, no, 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 no. Yes, respect awakening, yes, yes, respect the monastics in particular. But fundamentally, Brahmin or untouchable, monastic or householder, man or woman, adult or child, you are responsible for your own practice. Make an island of yourself. Make yourself your refuge. There is no other refuge. And then he says, make Dhamma, which is reality or truth, as well as an accurate description of the truth. I'll just call it the truth. Make the truth your island. Make the truth your refuge. There is no other refuge. So we rest over here in our refuge of truth. We regulate ourselves. We work with our intentions. We know it's on us. We sit in the other half of the story, which that half is equanimity about them. The other half is being responsibility for our own practice, self-reliance over here. We rest over here, and we rejoice and exult in our good deeds. And then the home run quote from the Zen master Hakuin. He says, pointing directly at the heart-mind, in other words, the underlying process, really, of mind, the arising and the passing away of things, deeper than content, the process that holds content, that represents content, of thoughts, sights, tastes, touches, smells, and sights, right? Pointing directly to your own heart, mind, see your own nature. And in so doing, become Buddha. These Zen masters, they don't mince words, do they, Tarne? Pointing directly to the heart, mind, see your own nature and become Buddha. Looking directly at mind, see your own nature, see the nature of mind, and in effect, recognize that its nature is your nature is Buddha. The ultimate form of self-reliance. So let's sit with this for a minute. Thank you for your practice.
Thank you.
See you next week.
Happy birthday to your wife.
Yeah. She's an awesome wife, too.